Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. Today's podcast is episode 3 of season 4. Today's guest is Zoe Smith. Zoe Smith created Mexico City-based BE School when she saw a gap in the market for English programs that were based on business skills and confidence for Mexican professionals. BE School works with dozens of international corporations with customized courses tailored for individual and industry needs. I'd like to remind you also of the upcoming EFL Magazine TOEFL Summit on the 28th and 29th of January. The link is at the bottom in the show notes, so please check it out and get in contact anytime. Thanks again.
Hey everyone, buckle up for a new episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast, the one and only podcast made to help you launch your business or take your existing business to a level of success you could never have imagined. Whether you're a school owner, freelancer, publisher, or other entrepreneur, you're sure to pick up lots of actionable advice when you listen to the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. Remember to visit EFLmagazine.com for great articles and features. Without further ado, here's your host, the founder of EFL Magazine, Philip Pound.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. And I'm delighted today to have Zoe Smith. And Zoe is the CEO and founder of BE School. The Spanglish struggle is real. It says on her profile on LinkedIn. What's that all about?
The Spanglish struggle. Well, anybody that knows me knows that I continually struggle with learning Spanish. So I think that's more what it refers to. But certainly, of course, in the journey of learning a language, unless you happen to grow up immersed in a language, for adults, learning a language is really tough. It's really hard. And hence, actually, why BE School came to be founded, to help people with their confidence with that, actually.
Right. So you should try learning Japanese. You'll love it. So tell me a little bit about your background, Zoe. You're in, is it London today or where are you?
I'm in Bristol at the moment.
Bristol. Gotcha.
Visiting for the holidays with my parents and my daughter, visiting family and everything. So I'm from Bristol. I moved from Bristol. Well, I was at university in Sheffield, went from there and lived in Canada, in Calgary, for a few years. And then I met my now ex-husband, who was also in Calgary, but he was Mexican. And eventually we made the move down to Mexico City, which was about 11 years ago now. So even though we're not together anymore, I've continued to stay in Mexico City whilst building my business. It's been quite an exciting journey.
Yeah, sorry for saying you're from London. Of course, you're from Bristol. I think you may have mentioned that before.
You're British as well. Everybody from Mexico says, oh, London, but you're British. You should know better.
Yeah, so it's... Yeah, I think Bristol is one of my favorite places. I think one of not just that you're here, but I had the great fortune to visit a few years ago, and I love traveling on the Avon and all the great pubs and the cider, and it was nice in the summertime. Even all the wasps were friendly on the day.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's beautiful here right now, so I've not left the suburbs yet to get into the city, but I imagine the docks are full of people and the beer gardens are packed, I would imagine, right now. So it's beautiful.
It is a bit of a trek up to the bridge though, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but it's worth a visit for sure.
It is, yeah. My vertigo did kind of come into play there when I was up there. It is right. Vertiginous, yeah. So it's a beautiful city. Anybody who's in the UK, please do visit Bristol, and it's got the best accent as well. It has the high roticity there, the strong R sounds.
Yeah. So Banksy and Massive Attack, indeed.
Yeah, exactly, and I think every day is speak like a pirate day in Bristol. Yeah. So you start. And farmer, yeah, maybe the apples from the orchards and bring in the cider. But so you started off in Bristol. I just had a look at your LinkedIn profile. I actually, the only time I look at people's LinkedIn profiles is I'm not, you know, a a recruiter is for this. So I noticed actually a guest of ours a couple of weeks back, Nicola Prentice, also did a degree in philosophy. I think I've had a few. I think Mark Pemberton from StudyCat, who I interviewed about 6, 8, maybe 9 months ago, I don't know what it is now, also a degree in philosophy. So how did that equip you for a business career, do you think?
I'm not sure that it did necessarily. The philosophy degree when I took it was actually more, I was just interested in philosophy. I'd always been quite good at English literature and things like that. So my degree, I'm not sure how much it informed my business life now. I think my personal journey has probably informed that quite a lot more. When I was living in Canada, I was living with some family out there who were super entrepreneurial. My cousin started a business in the childcare industry at a time when Calgary was booming because of the oil industry and people needed childcare like crazy. And I helped her kind of build and establish that business from one day home to it was like 25 by the time I left Calgary. So I think that was kind of more my first introduction to entrepreneurship. And she also happened to be kind of into a lot of personal development stuff, whether it's reading or audios. And for me, that was a completely foreign sort of cheesy world. But obviously, after spending several years with her, I kind of got hooked on personal development type material. I don't think I've picked up a fictional book in about 12 years or 15 years or more. So when I moved to Mexico, I was actually, you know, I kind of went on a little bit of a whim. I was following my heart. I went to Mexico for love, as many, many people do. I didn't really know what I was going to do when I was there. I had a degree, like you said, I had some business experience, but I wasn't entirely sure where the direction was going to take me. So then I did the kind of typical foreigner thing when in a foreign country and started teaching English. That went really well. And I find that I really enjoyed it. I've come from a teaching background anyway. My dad's a former head teacher. I've been teaching kids in Calgary. We've got a few teachers in our family. So it did come quite naturally to me to do. But what I found was I was working for a couple of different schools, one being kind of a very big international school and another a much smaller scale, kind of more specialized English. And what I found after about a year or so of doing that is that the main block for a lot of students was their confidence. So it wasn't that they couldn't necessarily kind of, you know, drill through exercise in a textbook. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Even I can do that in Spanish. but when it came to really applying it to real world, real life, it was way more challenging. And this was back again 10 years ago or so when business English wasn't such a thing that it is now. So I kind of saw an opportunity I was teaching a private student as well, who is now my business partner. And he spoke really good English. But again, when he did lots of presentations, he did lots of calls. This was back when, you know, he was flying around doing sales meetings with people in the States and Europe and whatever. And he just didn't quite have enough confidence. So he worked really heavily on that. So between that and there wasn't a niche for business English at the time, I kind of saw an opportunity to get something started. So the original idea for the business actually was not to start a school. It was to develop a program, more like a curriculum, focused around specific skills. So, you know, giving strong instructions to a presentation, for example, answering Q&A, again, just being more confident with body language, speech delivery, all of those kinds of things. So I did develop that and develop kind of a course, and then I sold it to one of the schools that I was working for. So the original idea was actually like, oh, maybe I can keep developing curriculum and sell them to other schools. But then my business partner was like, well, why don't you just start a school? I was like, oh, and I was foreign. I barely spoke any Spanish at the time. You know, I was a foreigner living there, and it, you know, it seemed to be kind of something that was like completely out of reach to do. So I thought it, my partner at the time, you know, I talked to him about it and I was like, oh no, I was kind of wavering. And then eventually my now business partner came back to me and said, well, if you do it, I really have confidence that you can do this. There's a huge market for this in Mexico and I'll help you get the business set up. And that's where we started. So from there, we've developed the school.
So you, I can't remember what they're called, but you know, you get these charts from your social media sharing at the end of the year, which words you've used most. I'll put it in the show notes. I always say that and then I forget. But I think the word you've used most here today already is confidence. And you mentioned that you were, you know, you were in Bristol. Your mindset changed. I mean, it's a culture change, isn't it? I mean, now I think things are a little bit different, but you know, growing up like in the 80s, 90s, and we saw a lot of this mindset stuff, prosperity gospel, maybe Norman Vincent Peale, the whole Anthony Robbins thing. And we think, oh, these people, you know, this is completely alien to like what we would say, self-effacing people, or, you know, people who should like hide their light under a bushel, whatever way you want to put it. So your mindset changed there from going to Canada, what you learned there, and also the hands-on business experience. And then you went to Mexico, you grew a little bit more in confidence, you gave others confidence, and then it got to the point where you started your school. So that was all about expanding your, you know, your possible, wasn't it? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, and as you said, I think mindset, especially being British, you know, like you said, you know, the humble brag is kind of, you know, when you're British, that's not even a thing. Like, you cannot be dreaming big. You cannot be kind of, you know, thinking beyond the possibilities of your world. And when I was in Canada, it was just the culture, well, the culture that I was surrounded with was just super opposite to that. And I just kind of, again, when I was first introduced to the, even the what we would have called then self-help, you know, it was just so foreign to me. Like, it was all cheesy and I didn't really get on board at all. You know, you kind of go through life with this kind of mindset of like, you go to school, you go to university, you get a job, and you just do what you do. And that's kind of the scale of it. So then being introduced to the possibility of like, well, you can have different directions. You could own a business, all those things. It was something that it just gradually seeped in. I was like, okay, yeah, no, maybe I can do something. And I was already doing something different. I'd already traveled. I was obviously living in a foreign country. So, you know, I'm a middle child in my family. I have an older brother, an older sister and a younger brother who both have super, you know, did the academic, super corporate thing. They've both been really successful in their careers. And I was the one that kind of just took off. I guess my mindset was already a little bit different. And I was certainly, I always loved traveling. So moving countries for me was not necessarily scary. But certainly starting a business, and had I not helped my cousin, I think, in Canada do that, I'm not sure if I would have had the confidence to have started something by myself in Mexico. I don't know if I would have thought that it was even a possibility. So I guess that maybe a lot of your listeners are in this kind of position of wanting to scale in terms of what they're doing, in terms of, you know, obviously I'm in the world of a lot of teachers that have like private students, for example, and to kind of think bigger than that and think, oh, can I just earn a bit more than my few students or whatever that I have a month and everything. I personally wouldn't have had the confidence to do that had I not sort of seen it in action myself. And as I mentioned, when I started the business, I barely spoke any Spanish. I was a foreigner. You know, I was actually pregnant not long after starting the business as well. And it just forced me to sort of be a bit bold and be a bit brave. And, you know, I remember going into sales meetings, again, not speaking a word of Spanish and just kind of blagging my way through it a little bit. But, you know, it was all served to, again, build my confidence. But I think because I believed so much in what I was doing as well, that really helped. That was a big part of it, is that, again, business English is much more of a thing now. It wasn't then. It was much more kind of generic English, or, you know, bullet style or whatever. And to focus kind of in on the area was like, okay, well, you need English that you can really actually apply to your job and come out of each lesson with something that you can do immediately, regardless of what level you're at. That was something that was quite new at the time.
So you mentioned the childcare industry in Canada. So what business fundamentals did you learn by working in childcare?
Well, working with children, for sure, which is obviously a challenging. Anybody that has children knows that. So I started off actually running one of the day homes, which was just part of the growth of the business model. So I spent a couple of years looking after children, developing curriculum. And the differentiation of that business model was, you know, making the daycare a little bit more structured, but it was, they were in houses. So the idea was that the person that ran it lived in the house, but the whole house was set up for children. So it was a blend between what you might call a big daycare and someone babysitting at their house, if you like. So I learned, and that's probably one of the biggest lessons I learned, was because I had, when I came out of working with the kids, I then helped develop the whole business, and that obviously involved working with parents. So it wasn't about pleasing the kids, it was about pleasing the parents. So I did tons and tons and tons of meetings with parents to tell them about the program, to assure them of their safety of their children, what they would be learning. You know, it was a premium day home, so it was more expensive than a lot of the day homes that were around at the time. So I think sales was certainly one of the biggest things that I learned, and that was just talking to people many, many, many times. My cousin was kind of she's got a huge, larger than life personality, and she was brilliant at this. So spending so much time with her, it certainly rubbed off on me. And, you know, for someone that I know, I'm quite introverted by nature, but you learn how to kind of become your more confident self when you're thrown into those kinds of situations, that you just kind of, you can develop a way to kind of switch it on when you need to. And that was probably the biggest thing I got out of that experience.
Exactly. And, you know, it's horses for courses, isn't it? Because yeah, there's different kinds of sales, and somebody who works, like, say, in kindergarten or, you know, that can build more of a rapport, just have a conversation, you know, empathize with needs. I mean, that's...
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people will say that they hate sales. If you ask anybody, like, sales, it's kind of almost kind of like a tainted swear word or something. But, you know, a great quote that I heard once is that people don't hate sales, they hate rejection. So it's kind of, you know, everybody actually loves sales. If you sell something to somebody, it's a great feeling. So people really love sales, they just don't like being rejected. But I think when you really believe in what you're doing, whether it was the daycare homes that I started with or B-School now, the rejection also almost doesn't matter, because it's like, okay, if it's not necessarily for everybody, you know, but the ones that it is for, you know, you, again, it's easy to create that rapport, even if you're doing it in a second language and and blagging your way through it. When you really care about what you're doing and it's the right fit for the right person, then sales is a really great thing.
So then we'll move on to when you went to Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so we'll talk a little bit more about the business school and English in Mexico. But so tell me a couple of things about moving to Mexico. First, some culture shocks, and then business culture in Mexico. I don't know much about it, so I'd be interested to hear how things are conducted there.
Yeah, for sure. So when I first moved, I was the guy that I was with, we were, you know, boyfriend and girlfriend at the time. So we were young and able to explore the city, and it was all very new to me. I'd gone down to Mexico City once before that to visit him for a week, and that's my first time ever going to Mexico. And then the next time I went was when I moved there. So everything was a culture shock. You know, what I found quickly was that people were super nice, super friendly. A lot of people did speak English, which made it, you know, easier for me to start with. But I think, you know, the food is a huge culture in Mexico. And I learned early on as well that, you know, again, being British, you know, if somebody invites you to your home, invites you food, you're kind of like, oh, no, it's okay, it's okay. And I learned quickly that when people offer you food in Mexico, you just say yes, regardless if you're hungry or not, you just say yes. Take the food, take the tacos. You know, things like just being, I guess, you know, whereas again, being British, you may have dinner time at sort of 6-7 in the evening, maybe 8 at the latest, you know, you're having dinners and going out at like, you know, 9-10 o'clock at night, those kinds of things. Obviously, Mexico City is a huge city, so that was one of the biggest things. So even when I started teaching there, you know, these were not days where there was Uber or I could even have afforded an Uber if I wanted to take it. You know, I was working my way around on the public transport, the metro, around all the city, and it was insane. I can't even believe that I did it now when I think about it. So you know, it's a mega city at the end of the day. So learning to get around was a huge thing. So yeah, and then I had a great experience in the first year or so there. And it was just kind of being exposed to all sides of Mexico. And the benefit of the guy that I was with at the time was being Mexican, was that I got to really be immersed in Mexican culture. Now, like, there's tons of Americans in Mexico City, tons of foreigners in general. I think if I'd come there in my present state of life and just gone, I would have really been in this kind of expat bubble. Whereas, you know, going and being there with a Mexican, it gave me exposure to really what life is like in Mexico. And I'm super grateful for that.
And the business culture, I mean, attitudes to like formality, timekeeping, you know, how decision making. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So again, later on in the stages of the business, when I was doing meetings, again, moving around the city. So this is all corporate offices, international companies. People are generally really friendly. I think that's the general feel. And again, I think approaching people in a way, I think not speaking as much Spanish then, it's kind of humbled me, obviously just internally humbled me. But I think people kind of really respond to you when you're not trying to be the greatest and the best at everything. So when it's obvious to people that I was struggling with speaking Spanish, it automatically kind of warmed people to me. So I think that kind of work, you can use your weaknesses to your benefit sometimes, right? Because if I would have spoken like fluent Spanish, and my whole demeanor and attitude would have been completely different probably going into those situations. Whereas when I'm kind of going in with a weakness that they can relate to, also it immediately builds rapport with people, which is really good. In terms of the culture, in terms of business culture there, for, you know, the people that I was meeting with, again, people are generally pretty friendly. Certainly I had some meetings where people were a little bit more pushed for time and they kind of more rush you a little bit and they're kind of like, yeah. But that was rare that happened. Generally, if people are taking meetings with you, they're going to give you time, take you for lunch, you know, do all of those things, which is great. And it's a great way to kind of, you know, spend time with people. Timekeeping is a whole different thing in Mexico. I learned that was a cultural shock for me. Again, like, you know, being British, like, you know, if someone says that an event or party or dinner or something starts at 7, 8, whatever, you get there on time. In Mexico, you can expect people won't arrive to something at least an hour after that. So meetings, not too bad. The people are quite punctual. But again, it's a mega city. Traffic happens. People are late. That's pretty normal, I would say, for Mexican culture. And even for our students, I would say that that's the case too. So timekeeping, we have to keep people really on the ball with the timekeeping for sure.
And are people pretty direct, or do you have to kind of read the room?
No, I wouldn't say they are actually. You know, there's a one thing again, like now the business is bigger and obviously I'm corresponding with a lot of people all the time, and especially with accounting matters and whatnot, people really do try to avoid confrontation quite a lot. In the Mexican culture, like, people do not want to say that they've made a mistake and they do not want to say no. So people, that's what I have to get used to actually early on with the sales side of things, is that people were more likely to say nothing than to say no, thank you. So therefore, you kind of do waste time sometimes kind of trying to follow up with someone when they just can't say, this isn't for us right now. That can be quite frustrating. Now, running the business, again, you know, mistakes get made, whether they're small or big ones. But when it's from the side of the client that they've made a mistake about something, they will not say, sorry, I made a mistake, let me fix that. They'll just ignore it, or ignore your email, or blame someone else, or something, right? Or blame you is the kind of the more common thing that happens. And that's a really interesting, and now I'm used to it, but it was certainly challenging to come from somewhere where, you know, I'm the first to, you know, I make mistakes all the time, and I'm the first to kind of say, sorry, I'll fix that, or I got that wrong, or let me go back and redo that, or whatever it is. But to then be confronted with a culture that doesn't do that, it's certainly quite challenging sometimes. But you just have to learn to be kind of over polite. And also, you know, I'm not the kind of person that would humiliate people anyway. But certainly when you're kind of in an email chain and there's a bunch of people copied in and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's going to be really bad news if you point blame in another direction. So, you know, that's obviously kind of a no-no in business culture for sure, in Mexico at least.
Yeah, maybe they warmed you because maybe their perception of a lot of foreigners maybe is that they're very direct, rude and loud-mouthed. Is that?
Could be. Yeah, I mean,
Americans, sorry for my brush stroke there. Yeah.
Yeah. Americans probably have that reputation a bit more, I would have guessed. But yeah, no, you definitely find cultural differences, but and mostly they're positive ones, though, I would say. Again, one thing that worked to my benefit, I think that, you know, unfortunately, I think a lot of people in Mexico have a little bit of an inferiority complex, especially when you're talking about the comparison to the States. And so you notice right away that, you know, if you are British or if you're American or whatever, that they automatically think that you're more special. So I think that certainly helped with the branding of the school, that it was British run and all of those things. I think it just automatically gave the whole thing more credibility. So, you know, that certainly works in my favor. It's an unfortunate sort of cultural thing. And again, like part of our teaching to our students is like, you're not inferior to anybody, and you need to understand that. But the best way for you to do that is to be able to speak confidently in these situations, because what happens is that with the language breakdown is that they are completely competent, able and professional in their own field. Get them onto a call where they don't understand what someone's saying. And of course, it not only do they feel incompetent, but it comes across like they actually are. So that's one of the biggest kind of barriers that we try to work with our students as well. It's kind of like, you don't have to speak perfectly. This is not about perfect grammar, but you need to be able to express an idea. And that's what we work with.
Okay. And you said something, well, you said a lot of things interesting, but you said something interesting earlier about the vulnerability, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So you said that, you know, making mistakes in the language, and I'm sure a lot of listeners can, you know, they can recount similar experiences of, you know, being in a classroom and actually admitting you don't know something. And then the students, you know, there's a real sea change, isn't there, in the class. A lot of students actually warm to you a lot more and maybe more open. You know, they reciprocate, don't they? With, you know, if you can be open about these things, I can as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's super true. And I think being human is like a big part of all of our experiences, regardless of what career that you're in or what profession or how you're interacting with people. I think the human side of us is what everybody can relate to. And as I said, like one thing that certainly worked to my advantage, as I mentioned, was not speaking Spanish very well. It certainly helped me create that rapport with people in that field. But you know, when I started the business, it was a huge struggle personally as well. And my personal journey has kind of gone alongside the growth of the business. So because I was also going through so much in my personal life, it meant that I kind of just had to hustle over here to kind of keep things together. But, you know, there was moments when, you know, I was heavily pregnant for part of this journey, you know, showing up to meetings and you're kind of like just a giant disaster to people. You know, it's just all part of our shared human experience, I suppose.
Yeah, it reminds me of Frances McDormand in Fargo. You know, she spends most of the movie heavily pregnant, doesn't she?
Right.
During the catching the serial killers. But of course, vulnerability is good, and you know, we can talk about Brené Brown, all these books. But I know a fellow LinkedIn user, this vulnerability thing has been kind of weaponized.
Yeah.
Over the past few years, hasn't it?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think there's a huge difference. And I've often got a very controversial opinion about this, about being a victim of something and being vulnerable. And they're two really, really different things. You know, I'm a mixed race person. My mother is Black. My father is white. We grew up in a white neighborhood. You know, I don't live in inner city Bristol. I live out, you know, they live out in the countryside. And I think that what my parents, you know, my dad being a former head teacher, my mum coming from Jamaica, she forged a super corporate career here. And they never, luckily, like fortunately for me, they didn't speak those kinds of limitations into me. They weren't like, well, because you're Black, you're going to have, you know, it's going to be harder for you, or you're going to have less opportunities. You know, me and my siblings didn't grow up with that being spoken into us. So for me, that was never a barrier. The same as being a woman. You know, my mum's been very successful in her corporate career. You know, she's been a working mum my whole life, and I never saw being a woman as a barrier to entry for something. So fortunately for me, you talked about, you know, the cultural differences when in Mexico, I know for some people that we've been, you know, a young Black woman trying to build business relationships in Mexico City, that would be almost impossible because of the belief systems that they have that, oh my God, well, because I'm a woman, they're going to not like me. Because I'm Black, they're going to be racist. You know, because I'm young, they're not going to take me seriously. I just chose not to put those labels on myself and didn't use them as excuses to not just go out and do it. Versus vulnerability, on the other hand, is that I had legitimate things that were going on in my life. You know, shortly after I started the business again, I was pregnant. My husband left about 6 months later, and I had to make a choice about whether I was going to stay and make this work or whether I was going to bail and go back to England. So the vulnerability, in a sense, was not being a victim of my situation. It was, I'm really tired today. And, you know, I might not be looking at my best, or, you know, I've had to cancel meetings, or, you know, teachers, we didn't have an office, of course, then. And I was meeting teachers in, you know, Starbucks and, a hot mess when I was recruiting people and all this stuff. And that's a different kind of vulnerability than being a victim of your circumstances, I think.
Absolutely. And I think nowadays is some people are act as victims, but then other people champion people as victims, don't they? That's another kind of narcissism, whatever they call communal narcissism, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So as a matter of interest, race in Mexico, what are the dynamics there? I don't know much about.
I mean, it's quite a diverse population, I suppose, but not as much as you would experience in other countries. Again, there's certain areas of the city that are very expat-y. There's loads of foreigners around and everything. But that's, you know, a very small proportion of the city compared to the size of the city. You know, I've never experienced anything negative. The funny thing was, is because my ex was quite white and blonde, you know, especially for a Mexican, that when we were out and if we would be speaking in English together, people would assume that he was the foreigner and I was the Mexican, which was always quite funny and quite amusing. But, you know, I think that within Mexican culture itself, it can be quite racist as well, you know, depending on the tone of your skin color and everything. And again, it's not something that I've experienced personally, but certainly, you know, you hear things and it's tangible in some parts of the city. It is the socioeconomic divide is more tangible, I think, than racism. You know, the disparity between the poor and the rich there is massive. It is in all countries, to be fair, but it's very tangible there because people really are kind of side by side with this extreme wealth and extreme poverty. And there's a huge difference between what's going on in the socioeconomic divide there, for sure.
And of course, as you said, Mexico is a huge country. Mexico City is huge. And there are so many different linguistic and cultural ethnic differences within Mexico as well.
Right. Yeah, no, and there is. And again, you go from Mexico City, you know, the Riviera Maya, Cancun, and all those places, it's one, you know, most Mexicans speak English there because they have to, because it's a tourist industry, obviously, versus the Oaxaca coast, which is now becoming more touristy, but you know, it's beautiful and much more traditional, and it's amazing. And then the small pueblos and everything. And there's a lot of different culture that you can find in Mexico. You know, I think possibly I haven't been much to northern Mexico, but I imagine that's probably more heavily influenced by US culture. But certainly the further you go south, it's very traditional and awesome and wonderful, and food is amazing. And so there's a lot of great things about Mexico, for sure.
Great. So I'll want to circle back. We'll use that American phrase. Sorry, that one has slipped in. But we come back to starting the school. So we stopped off at where you developed your curriculum, and they said, "Well, why don't start a school?" Tell me about the steps there. How you went about that, and your
So this was is a good story because as I said, I abandoned the idea of selling a curriculum, so to speak, and chose to dive in terms of getting the school started. So again, it was a student that I had at the time. He had a full-time job and a family, but he'd also started other businesses in Mexico. So he said, okay, let's get this started. So the start of that it was sort of a non-official start that I just started thinking about other students. He obviously knew some people that needed English lessons. And the whole thing started with me teaching some more lessons privately. We weren't a corporate entity then. And then again, as I said, I was pregnant. So then what I was able to do became less. So, I hired a couple of teachers, and it was, you know, this was a handful of students we had at the very beginning stages. And then, as I mentioned, I separated from my partner quite shortly after our daughter was born. And it was just a decision. I was like, okay, well, what am I going to do? And at the time, I was actually kind of still fighting for the marriage. So I was kind of quite determined and wanted to still be in Mexico. So I spent a bit of time back in the UK with my parents, and I just hustled. I started doing cold calling. And again, my Spanish was really limited. So I would have my newborn during the day, and at night, because of the time difference, I was here in the UK and Mexico was still open for business, so to speak, at sort of 8, 9 at night here. So I just literally got on the internet, Googled companies and called, made tons of phone calls. I would spend a couple of hours every single night doing that. And it was terrible. It was a shit show for most of it. You know, I got a lot of no's. I got a lot of reception desks that wouldn't put me through to the right person, but I just kept going. And eventually I just got to the right person that worked for a big auto car company. And she said, yeah, we're looking for this. Like, come and meet with me. So I was like, I kind of panicked a little bit because I was obviously in England and I was like, oh my God. And this was, again, this is pre-pandemic. So you really had to be there, like in the office to do the meeting. It wasn't like I could be like, oh, can we do a Skype? It wouldn't have been the right thing at that moment. So I booked the meeting. I was like, okay, my parents luckily helped me out. They were willing to keep my daughter for a week whilst I thought, okay, well, if I'm going to go book more meetings, if I'm going to make the trip out there. So I got a couple more meetings, and then a student that I used to teach with another school also happened to get in touch with me and said that he was the HR manager now at this other conglomerate. And they were looking for classes. So I'm like, great, I'm going to be in Mexico City in about, in a few weeks, let's meet. And so out of that one trip that I kind of took a huge chance on, I got two corporate clients. We were not a registered business entity then. So again, it was just saying yes to a bunch of stuff that I did not know how to do. I had no idea how I was going to execute it, but I was just like, yes, okay, we can do this. We'll do it. And from there, obviously then we needed to become a proper registered corporation. So my business partner helped me get all of that stuff set up. We did that. It took about 6 months. So what it meant is that we started classes with one of the companies, and it probably was about 3 months that we did classes before even getting paid. So again, having the business partner, he helped fund the payroll. We hired a bunch of teachers, got started on. We just had to figure it out, you know, as we went. And then, meanwhile, in the background, I'm still going through this very messy separation issue. I'm back with my parents. I'm going back and forth, and all this, and then. Finally, about 2 years later, we weren't big. We had a few more clients going on, but I was ready to kind of make the move properly back to Mexico City by myself with my daughter, who was about 3 then at that time. So I did move back. I saved money. And again, by this point, I think it's important as well to just mention that I think when you start a business, it's, you know, it sucked being, you know, 30 something, living back with my parents, and, you know, I was earning no money. You know, so it was really hard in that sense as well, that you can't expect to start a business and start taking a salary. It's possibly different for people that have large investment or capital that go into their businesses. But when you're hustling and bootstrapping a business, you can't expect to take a salary that's going to support you. I was taking basic living expenses for the first couple of years at least. I certainly wasn't paying myself properly. So luckily my parents supported that. But again, talking about being humble, you know, I had to suck it up. My friends, meanwhile, are earning tons of money and living in houses that they bought. And I was back living with my parents with a newborn and not earning any money. It sucked. But so then I saved enough to be able to kind of move back. And so I did, and that was in 2017. And then about 3 months later, a huge earthquake was in Mexico City, and my building was one of the ones that fell down, and I was in it when it fell. So that was obviously a terrifying moment. Luckily, I survived it after being trapped in the building. And my daughter, thank God, was at her preschool that day. Otherwise, it could have been a whole different story. So again, like, this was another thing, like, just as we were getting a bit of traction at the beginning of the business and things were kind of, you know, steadily moving along, this giant disaster happens. I lost my home, nearly lost my life. We were homeless, like, from one second to the next. And again, fortunately, we had support. You know, I knew people in Mexico then, and they were extremely helpful to us. We stayed in people's houses and whatnot. But it took another 2 months to find another place to live. And obviously, everything was chaos in the city. It was like a war zone for a good month or so, well, more than that, a few months after. And everybody was just, you know, in shock and horror at what happened. A lot of people died, and people in the building that we were living in died. And it was a really difficult moment, and especially with a young child as well, it was really hard. But that, interestingly enough, was, again, by then I had a small team of teachers, and they stepped up and they kept going. You know, when business sort of went back to normal a little bit more after the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, and we resumed classes. They just stepped up and took. I didn't have a laptop. My laptop was gone. Everything I owned was gone. I couldn't operate the business in any way, and they just took care of business, and I learned to delegate. So before that, I think I've been really hands-on with every single micro detail of the business, because, you know, you're building it and you care. And after that, I learned to delegate really quickly. So that was kind of the beginning stages, and it was tough, but I think you just have to trust a little bit in the outcome sometimes, and trust if you believe in what you're doing, and not get attached also to outcomes of things. I think, you know, had I been like, this has to be the only one thing that could ever happen in my life that will ever be great, that would have created a whole different scenario, as opposed to, okay, let's give this a try, and like hope that it works and hope for the best, is definitely different mindsets.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to unpack there, but I just was struck by, you know, in business, you know, we always at the survivor bias, isn't it? The people generally, they attribute business success to certain things that may not have caused the success in the business or not, or circumstances and fortune came right into play, wasn't it? So fortune really played its hand with you. You got a good hand, and then you got a bad one. I mean, the first one I can look at is the cold calling. Obviously, you know, you had the will and the staying power to keep doing it, and to live with the discomfort of not knowing what you're doing and being embarrassed and having to use that language. There's so many hurdles to get over. But what I was struck by was you managed to ring a corporate company, and just at that time they were looking for somebody. Now, you know, I'll say this as somebody who's been a salesperson, called thousands of people in my previous life, it very rarely do you pick up a phone and the person wants it right there, right now, right, at exactly the right thing. So it was a little bit fortunate, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if I believe in luck in the way that people use the word. You know, it came, you know, I think that wasn't, again, that was probably the 70 to 80th call that I've made. So I certainly, you know, I hate people that kind of go for this kind of like, it always has to be hustle and grind and hard work. And I don't believe that, you know, I certainly used to believe that. And I think, you know, fortune can come to you when, you know, you have a good mindset about things. It was consistency, you know, it was a consistent effort over time. And I think that most people give up, you know, when they don't see an immediate result, you know. And cold calling, I think, is akin almost to, you know, working out or learning a language. You know, you see no progress and no results for a while, and then something happens that feels like luck and it feels like fortune, but it's the result of your consistency. You know, because probably, you know, and certainly it was opportune circumstance that they were absolutely looking at the time that I called. But if they had been the first person that I'd called, I'm not sure that necessarily would have gotten traction, you know. So I think certainly there's such a thing as, I think I prefer to think of it more like synchronicity than luck. You know, I think that when you've prepared yourself, when you're mentally ready, when you have, you know, shown the universe, so to speak, that you're ready for something, then it will present itself. So had that call happened at the beginning of my journey, it might not have had the same result, as opposed to when I was showing that I was willing to kind of make all this work, and then that phone call hit and we got the contract. So and I had to do the meeting after the call too, so that was, luckily she was a lovely person, and you know, they're still clients now, you know, 6 years on, and they are great clients of ours. But yeah, I think consistency it's really the key to most things.
Exactly. And it's like the Gary Player quote, isn't it? The more I practice, the luckier I get. That's how it works. Like, yeah.
Exactly.
And another quote I can think of is actually from Zorro, wasn't it? I remember the Antonio Banderas, Anthony Hopkins version, where it says, when the student is ready, the teacher will come. Isn't that it? Exactly. So it's
exactly. I mean, this is written in many ways, in many forms, in from ancient scripture to modern day self-help. You know, I think, I mean, again, it's a controversial opinion. I just don't believe in luck. I believe in opportunity and I believe in fortunate circumstances, but I don't think they come, you know, and again, as I've gone through life and many ups and downs and things, I've also come to realize the cyclical nature of all things as well. It's something that, you know, I read a lot of Eckhart Tolle, for example, and he talks about this quite a lot in his books, that I think there's this misconception that we always need to be kind of on an upward trajectory of life. And it feels good when we are. So of course, why wouldn't we want more of that? But life is cyclical in many different ways, and nature shows it. And as humans, we seem to find it somewhat intolerable to be in like the down part of the cycle or the bottom part of the cycle. And it becomes really uncomfortable for us. And, you know, if I look at, in hindsight, look at my own life, and I think, yeah, no, I've definitely had really good highs, some really extreme lows, and parts that you're building or parts that you're resting and becoming a bit more comfortable. I think the pandemic was a really good example of that. Again, I spent some time back in the UK during that, and it was a bit kind of like, you know, the business was a little bit stagnant. Things weren't, you know, everything was closed. You know, we all went through this kind of shared experience of the pandemic. And I was like, and at some point I just said, you know, you just be okay with this. Like, you're hustling and working all the time. Like, I barely stop. And actually now you've got an opportunity to, it's okay to rest. It's okay to allow yourself the recuperation. And, you know, in a good word for it, I discovered is the agricultural term fallow. So we know in Glastonbury, of course, they have the fallow year. So they allow the grounds to recoup, basically, and re-nourish and replenish itself. And as people, we really need to allow ourselves the moment to do the same thing, because that replenishment period of time is preparing you for the next upcycle, you know, that's going to happen. And, you know, I think something I'm constantly working on is just getting comfortable with whatever stage of the cycle that I'm at and not trying to fight against it so hard and thinking that everything always has to be amazing all of the time, you know.
Exactly. And you touched on also the doubt, the fallow periods, the self-doubt and the comparison, isn't it, to others. Yeah. You mentioned when you moved back home and you were living with your parents, and then you were casting your eye to your friends and you're seeing that they seem to have their lives in order, and they had the cars and their houses and, you know, their foreign holidays. And you think, oh my God, I've kind of lost my way here. But it's a trade-off, isn't it? I mean, absolutely. You know, would you swap a corporate job for the life that you work, or the life that you have? I mean,
no, I was talking to my mum about this just yesterday, actually. Again, all of my family have had corporate careers. And, you know, they've been brilliant at it, and they've done really well. Again, most of my friends are in that situation. I don't think any of my other friends or close friends have run businesses. And it's really tough. It can be very hard, you know, again, especially when you're in your 30s. And again, most of my friends, not all of them, but, you know, they're homeowners and doing really well. And they're, you know, they've got savings and money in the bank. And I had none of that. And I think from, you know, my parents have always been extremely supportive, but I know that they've worried about me a lot throughout the journey and wished I had a pension and all of those things. And it's tough. And luckily, I've not been someone that compares themselves too much to other people. I have a little bit been the kind of person in my life that I do kind of do my own thing. But, you know, like you said, the doubt and the fear creeps in at some point. But, you know, one of the, even though, you know, certainly in the early stages of the business, I was barely earning anything. I had total flexibility and total freedom to do what I wanted with my time. Even now, you know, we've come back to the UK for a month. I can work from here. You know, if I wanted to, I wouldn't want to, but if I wanted to just take a month off, I could. And that flexibility, especially when I've been raising a daughter by myself, you know, I don't know how I would have done it without that. I mean, people do it, obviously, of course they do. But I've been massively grateful for the flexibility and freedom that I've had, even when it's meant that I don't have a pension fund, so to speak.
So for anyone listening who's a budding entrepreneur or looking to set out on the journey, I know I interview a lot of people on this podcast, and we touch on the difficulties of entrepreneurship and you know, internally adjusting to uncertainty. And then, of course, outside factors like earthquakes and pandemics, they don't help either, do they? But you also said that the upsides very much outweigh the downsides.
Yeah, no, and again, you know, is the classic AA quote that a lot of us always come back to, you like, learn what you can control and what you can't. I can't control earthquakes, I can't control pandemics. I can control my emotions, I can control my work ethic. You know, I can control the people that I'm choosing to become part of my team. There's lots of factors that are within our control. And I think that definitely starts with your mind. You know, I'm constantly learning, growing in this area. And I think it's just so important to get thought discipline under control and understand what your limiting beliefs are as well. Again, as I mentioned when I started, luckily, my beliefs around building a business weren't as limited as some people's were, because I'd seen it done in Canada when I lived with my cousin there. My beliefs around that might have been very different had I not been exposed to that. But I think having a little bit of self-awareness of thinking, am I a person that always feels broke? Am I a person that always feels poor? Am I a person that always feels like, you know, I'm the only woman in the room and men are always kind of like, you know, being aware of that is a good step. You know, because then you can identify, okay, these are beliefs that I have that limit what I would like to do, and how am I going to shed them? You know, and sometimes that just exposing yourself to different experiences. Sometimes it's realizing that all of our beliefs are just made up and they're not real. you know, we all have them, but at the end of the day, they're self-made, they're not real. There's no truth in them whatsoever. And starting whatever journey that is for you to be able to sort of shed those beliefs and realize what they are, what's holding you back, and why do you even have those beliefs in the first place, and two, getting on the boat and starting the journey of actually getting rid of them. And for some belief systems that might be really quick, for some it might take years to do, but I think just being willing to start that journey is a good step for any entrepreneur, because you won't make it if you don't think you can. At the end of the day, if you really don't believe that you could build a business or surround yourself with the right people or build something, create something, then it absolutely won't work. And I certainly wouldn't suggest to any entrepreneur just to get in business because you think it's going to make a lot of money, because you won't for a while, probably.
So you mentioned, you know, dealing with limiting beliefs, and you mentioned Eckhart Tolle, and I think you touched on the right people as well. I think lesson number one is get rid of all the bad people, because that's going to be the biggest barrier, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And I think relationships, you have to, you know, to be fair, like for me, relationships have always been a fairly positive area of my life in terms of friendships and partnerships. That's not the case for everybody. Some people have very toxic friendships with people, or don't find it easy to get along with people, or, you know, whatever reasons. And, you know, that's been something in my life that's been a bit easier for me, I suppose. But it's certainly important to surround yourself with the right people. You know, I have a business partner that I trust implicitly. And also, I think it's important to know that different people come along at different times for you as well. Like, in the same way as we talked about cycles, people are seasonal as well. You know, and, you know, what might work in one moment of your life doesn't necessarily work in another moment of your life. And that's okay. It's not get too attached to people or situations or circumstances as well. You know, luckily I've always hired quite well, but I've certainly made mistakes as well. I'd like to think that I read people pretty well. CVs matter significantly less to me than the vibe I get of a person. But I've got it wrong sometimes as well. Or you know, I had a teacher just recently that's been with us for ages. It was doing an amazing job, and suddenly he just wasn't performing anymore. He was just doing a terrible, terrible job, and it was really hard. But I had to let him go, because after trainings, multiple chats, multiple warnings about various things, and I was like, "What's going on? This isn't like what's going on." I just had to be not make the whole thing personal as well.
So you didn't go on LinkedIn and cry about it.
No, I did not go on LinkedIn and cry about it. No, I know people really enjoy to do that. You know, and it's fine, like whatever, it gets a lot of likes and follows and all that kind of stuff. And I certainly share some personal stuff on LinkedIn occasionally, but yeah, I think we're probably, you and I, are on the same kind of attitude about that kind of thing. What grieves me about LinkedIn, sorry, just throwing this point in there, is that LinkedIn should be for, you know, promoting yourself or your talent, skills, whatever, or promoting your business. And the algorithm on LinkedIn like punishes that actively, it seems like. It's like, well, this is what the whole platform is for, surely, not to be sharing everybody's victim stories and stuff. That's a side note.
So Zoe, I really enjoyed our chat today. I have to head off a little bit because I have a chat just straight after this one.
Yeah,
Zoe, thanks again.
Thank you so much. It's a huge pleasure. And thank you so much for your time and letting me share my story. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the EFL Magazine Business Podcast with Philip Pound. For more great advice and resources, check out EFLmagazine.com. If you found this podcast helpful, be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. See you next time.